Kardashian.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr. and Jill Robbins. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, the $1.9 trillion spending plan signed into law by United States President Joe Biden Thursday provides more than just aid for the coronavirus health crisis. Some experts say it could cut the country's rate of child poverty in half. This historic legislation is about rebuilding the backbone of this country, Biden said as he signed the bill in the Oval Office. More than half of the money will go directly to Americans. Some will receive as much as $1,400. Others will receive payments related to job losses, food, housing, health, and child care. The rest will assist businesses, schools, and state and local governments affected by the coronavirus health crisis. In addition to the direct payments, the legislation, called the American Rescue Plan Act of 2021, would create a refundable tax credit of $3,600 for 1 year for children under 6 years of age and $3,000 for children between 6 and 17. Beginning in July, money will be sent to some families in monthly payments. The law also expands existing tax credits for people with costs related to the care of children and dependents. The research organization Urban Institute estimated that it will reduce poverty by more than one-third and by more than half for children in the year 2021. The Center on Poverty and Social Policy at Columbia University estimated that the law will cause nearly 12 million Americans, including more than 5 million children, not to be considered poor. It's a huge change, said Sarah Halpern Meekin of the Institute for Research on Poverty. She compared the legislation to the Social Security Act of 1935. That law established the system of retirement payments for older Americans, which is paid for by the Social Security tax. A study from the Tax Policy Center estimated that the law will raise the income of the poorest Americans by about 20% after they have paid taxes. The center noted that 70% of the tax savings will go to those making $91,000 or less. The bill received no support from Republican lawmakers. However, a public opinion study from the Pew Research Center suggests a large majority of Americans, 70%, support the legislation. Speaking after the House of Representatives vote on Wednesday to pass the bill, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said, "This is the most consequential legislation that many of us will ever be a party to." She added, "We celebrate because we are honoring a promise made by our president, and we join with him in promising that help is on the way." House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy denounced the bill as an attempt to expand socialism in the country. He said it is a list of liberal proposals that existed before the coronavirus health crisis. He said it did not meet the needs of American families. As it is written, the law will be in effect until the end of the year.
U.S. lawmakers from both major political parties are supporting legislation that makes it easier for media companies to negotiate deals with internet companies. The bill is aimed at making it easier for news organizations to negotiate collectively with companies like Google and Facebook. Senator Amy Klobuchar and Representative David Cicilline of the Democratic Party are introducing the legislation. Senator John Kennedy and Representative Ken Buck, both Republicans, are co-sponsors. The bill comes after Facebook had a legal fight with Australia over how much money publishers should make from their social media pages. During the dispute, Facebook blocked Australian news pages and only permitted their return after the government compromised. Facebook also promised a $1 billion investment in the news industry. The measure would permit print, broadcast, or digital news organizations to work together to gain better deals from Facebook and Google during a period of time. During that time, they would not be subject to antitrust laws meant to prevent big companies from unfairly influencing or controlling markets. The bill would require the negotiations to aid news publishers generally, rather than a small number of companies. Klobuchar said she was hopeful about the possibility of the measure becoming law. She said there is growing concern among lawmakers from both parties about monopolies, companies that control too much of a market or industry. Speaking about internet companies, commonly called technology companies, Klobuchar said, "Tech has no mercy." She said the bill would permit negotiations on everything from advertising revenue to access to information on subscribers. This bill will give hard-working local reporters and publishers the helping hand they need right now so they can continue to do their important work, Cicilline said in a statement. Klobuchar noted that most people now get their news online through Facebook and Google. Social media companies use news to get the attention of users and have been accused by news publishers of not sharing advertising revenue with them. The legislation could mean that struggling news organizations would receive more money for their products. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Parents always have concerns about the way their children speak. Personally, I am unhappy when I hear my children saying things like,
"Me and Eric will be there soon."
Now, I am learning that I should not worry. Over the past 20 years, English grammar teachers have developed some powerful new tools to learn about how people really use English. One such tool is the Corpus of Contemporary American English, or COCA. A corpus is a collection of language samples drawn from books, speeches, television programs, and online work. Researchers use computers to study the corpus. The COCA website says the purpose of looking at this body of information is to find out how native speakers actually speak and write, and how often people use individual words and expressions. As a result, the advice in grammar books has been changing. One of those rules is how to handle compound subjects. A sentence's subject is the person, place, or thing that is doing something or being something. Some call the subject the actor in the sentence. A compound subject means more than one person, place, or thing is doing or being something. They are joined with a word such as and to make the subject of a sentence. Some English language experts say that when you speak about yourself and someone else, you should speak of yourself last. Here is an example.
My friend and I are going to eat lunch together today.
And not,
I and my friend are going to eat lunch together today.
This is not an unbreakable grammar rule, but is considered by many to be more polite than putting yourself first. In past everyday grammar stories, you have probably read about another rule related to this kind of sentence. That is, you should use the subject pronoun I and not the object pronoun me when you are an actor in a sentence, as in this example.
Andy and I will be studying English tonight.
And not,
Andy and me will be studying English tonight.
One easy way to remember is to take the other subject out of the sentence. For example, you would not say,
me will be studying alone tonight.
You would say,
I will be studying alone tonight.
But the use of me as a subject pronoun seems to be growing more common. Mark Lieberman is a professor of linguistics at the University of Pennsylvania and founder of a language commentary blog called Language Log. Lieberman says that researchers looking at COCA found that me and someone is about 3 times more common than someone and me. Examples of the compound subject form, I and someone, are rare in the COCA. Here are some examples of this compound subject I found in COCA, with notes about their sources.
Me and Joe Biden were going to be on this Sunday.
On a television program with VOA reporter Greta Van Susteren.
Me and Kelly, we hang out.
On a television program without a trace. So what should you do as an English learner? You cannot go wrong by using someone and I for your compound subjects. It is correct. But if you break the rule, people will still understand what you are saying. We leave you with an excellent musical example of the me and someone form of the compound subject. Here is Janis Joplin performing Me and Bobby McGee, recorded in 1970.
Good enough for me.
I'm Jill Robbins.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we tell about the period known as the Cold War. The Cold War began after World War II. The main enemies were the United States and the Soviet Union. The Cold War got its name because both sides were afraid of fighting each other directly. In a hot war, nuclear weapons might destroy everything. So instead, both sides fought each other indirectly. They supported opposing sides in conflicts in different parts of the world. They also used words as weapons. They threatened and denounced each other, or they tried to make each other look foolish. Over the years, leaders on both sides changed, yet the Cold War continued. It was the major force in world politics for most of the second half of the 20th century. The Cold War world was separated into three groups. The United States led the West. This group included countries with democratic political systems. The Soviet Union led the East. This group included countries with communist political systems. The non-aligned group included countries that did not want to be tied to either the West or the East. Harry Truman was the first American president to fight the Cold War. He used several policies. One was the Truman Doctrine. This was a plan to give money and military aid to countries threatened by communism. The Truman Doctrine effectively stopped communists from taking control of Greece and Turkey. Another policy was the Marshall Plan. This strengthened the economies and governments of countries in Western Europe. A major event in the Cold War was the Berlin Airlift. After World War II, the United States and its allies divided Germany. Berlin was a part of communist East Germany. The city was divided into East and West. In June 1948, Soviet-led forces blocked all roads and railways leading to the western part of Berlin. President Truman quickly ordered military airplanes to fly coal, food, and medicine to the city. The planes kept coming, sometimes landing every few minutes for more than a year. The United States received help from Britain and France. Together, they provided almost 2.5 million tons of supplies on about 280,000 flights. The United States also led the formation of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization in 1949. NATO was a joint military group. Its purpose was to defend against Soviet forces in Europe. The Soviet Union and its East European allies formed their own joint military group, the Warsaw Pact, 6 years later. In 1953, Soviet leader Joseph Stalin died. His death gave the new American president, Dwight Eisenhower, a chance to deal with new Soviet leaders. In July 1955, Eisenhower and Nikolai Bulganin met in Geneva, Switzerland. The leaders of Britain and France also attended. Eisenhower proposed that the Americans and Soviets agree to let their military bases be inspected by air by the other side. The Soviets later rejected the proposal. Yet, the meeting in Geneva was not considered a failure. After all, the leaders of the world's most powerful nations had shaken hands. Cold War tensions increased, then eased, then increased again over the years. The changes came as both sides attempted to influence political and economic developments around the world. For example, the Soviet Union provided military, economic, and technical aid to communist governments in Asia. The United States then helped 8 Asian nations fight communism by establishing the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, known as CETO. In the 1950s, the United States began sending military advisors to help South Vietnam defend itself against communist North Vietnam. That aid would later expand into a long and bloody period of American involvement in Vietnam. The Cold War also affected the Middle East. In the 1950s, both East and West offered aid to Egypt to build the Aswan High Dam on the Nile River. The West canceled its offer, however, after Egypt bought weapons from the communist government in Czechoslovakia. Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser then seized control of the company that operated the Suez Canal. A few months later, Israel invaded Egypt. France and Britain joined the invasion. For once, the United States and the Soviet Union agreed on a major issue. Both supported a United Nations resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire. The Suez Crisis was a political victory for the Soviets. When the Soviet Union supported Egypt, it gained new friends in the Arab world. In 1959, Cold War tensions eased a little. The new Soviet leader, Nikita Khrushchev, visited Dwight Eisenhower in the United States. The meeting was very friendly. But the next year, relations got worse again. An American U-2 reconnaissance airplane was shot down over the Soviet Union. The plane and its pilot, Francis Gary Powers, were captured. Eisenhower admitted that such planes had been spying on the Soviets for years. In a speech at the United Nations, Khrushchev got so angry that he took off his shoe and beat it on a table. John F. Kennedy followed Eisenhower as president in 1961. During his early days in office, Cuban exiles invaded Cuba. It came to be known as the Bay of Pigs invasion. The forces wanted to oust the communist government of Fidel Castro. America's Central Intelligence Agency had provided training for the exiles. But the United States failed to send military planes to protect them during the invasion. As a result, almost all were killed or taken prisoner by Cuban forces trained and supported by the Soviet Union and Soviet allied nations. At the same time in Europe, tens of thousands of East Germans had been fleeing to the West. East Germany's government decided to stop them. It built a wall separating the eastern and western parts of the city of Berlin. Guards shot at anyone who tried to flee by climbing over.
During Kennedy's second year in office, American intelligence reports discovered Soviet missiles in Cuba.
This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere.
The Soviet Union denied the missiles were there. Yet American photographs taken from high in the air proved they were. America's ambassador to the United Nations, Adlai Stevenson.
Let me ask you one simple question. Do you, Ambassador Zorin, deny that the USSR has placed and is placing medium and intermediate range missiles and sites in Cuba? Yes or no? Don't wait for the translation. Yes or no?
Mr. Stevenson, would you continue your statement, please? You will receive the answer in the due course. Do not worry.
I'm prepared to wait for my answer until hell freezes over, if that's your decision. And I'm also prepared to present the evidence in this room.
The Cuban Missile Crisis easily could have resulted in a nuclear war. Americans felt especially threatened with those missiles just 150 kilometers from the Florida coast. But the crisis ended after a week. Khrushchev agreed to remove the missiles if the United States agreed not to interfere in Cuba. Some progress was made in easing Cold War tensions when Kennedy was president. In 1963, the two sides reached a major arms control agreement. They agreed to ban tests of nuclear weapons above ground, underwater, and in space. They also established a direct telephone link between the White House and the Kremlin. Relations between East and West also improved when Richard Nixon was president. He and Leonid Brezhnev met several times. They reached several arms control agreements. One reduced the number of missiles used to shoot down enemy nuclear weapons. It also banned the testing and deployment of long-distance missiles for 5 years. A major change in the Cold War would take place in 1985 when Mikhail Gorbachev became leader of the Soviet Union. He met four times with President Ronald Reagan. Gorbachev withdrew Soviet forces from Afghanistan, and he signed an agreement with the United States to destroy all middle-distance and short-distance nuclear missiles. By 1989, there was widespread unrest in Eastern Europe. Gorbachev did not intervene as one Eastern European country after another cut its ties with the Soviet Union. The Berlin Wall, the major symbol of communist oppression, was torn down in November of that year. In less than a year, East and West Germany became one nation again. A few months after that, Warsaw Pact countries officially ended the alliance. The Cold War was over.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.